I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. An international conference on the Korean crisis is underway today in Vancouver, Canada, without representatives from Russia and China. Have months of militant rhetoric between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un brought the world to the brink of an unthinkable war? Will the talks between North and South Korea in advance of the Winter Olympics help ease tensions? Frank Januzzi is the president and CEO of the Mansfield Foundation, a nonprofit organization that promotes understanding between Asia and the U.S. Josh Letterman covers the State Department and Foreign Affairs for the Associated Press. Plus, Amaha Kasa, who leads a network of African immigrants to the United States, on the president's racial slurs and its effect on America's standing in the world. Midday starts right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. President Trump added to a long list of foreign policy faux pas last week with his disparaging comments about Africans, Haitians, and others whom he deems unworthy to immigrate to the United States. This follows canceling a trip to Britain, a move that was greeted with joy by our closest ally, and extending sanctions relief to Iran in the nuclear deal while promising not to do so the next time around. Today, in Vancouver, British Columbia, the U.S. and Canada are holding a summit to talk about the crisis on the Korean Peninsula, amid small signs of hope for a de-escalation of tensions. The North and South are at least talking again and considering cooperation at the Winter Olympics next month. Frank Januzzi joins me in the studio. He's the president and CEO of the Maureen and Mike Mansfield Foundation. They concentrate on Asia issues. Frank, nice to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good to be here in Charles Village.
Josh Letterman covers foreign policy, national security, and the State Department for the Associated Press, and he joins us on the line from Washington. Josh, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom.
And you are welcome to join us as well, 410-662-8780. That's our number here at Midday, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So, Frank, you've been to the DPRK, or North Korea, on several occasions. What's your most recent trip, and what did you find when you went?
Well, in my former capacity at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee as their East Asia advisor, I traveled to North Korea in 2008. And at that time, we were really anticipating what we hoped would be a resumption of dialogue with North Korea. And my goal on that particular mission was to discuss the retrieval of the remains of American servicemen. And a lot of those bones are still in North Korea. We're trying to get cooperation from the North Koreans for their retrieval. I've had numerous contact with North Koreans since then, but I have not traveled to North Korea in the last 10 years.
So this is at the very end of the Bush administration, right before President Obama took office?
Just before Obama was coming into office. And in fact, my trip to North Korea, arranged by Senator Joe Biden, who was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at the time and was running for vice president, was really to lay the groundwork for what we hoped would be a better relationship ultimately between the U.S. and North Korea, one that would in fact, convince them to abandon their pursuit of nuclear weapons.
So Nick Kristof wrote about a trip that he took with some Times reporters to North Korea recently, the last few months. And he talked about, you know, the close handling that visitors to North Korea are subject to. I mean, I assume that was the case with you as well. But what did you see on the ground? What's it like on the streets of Pyongyang?
Well, you know, what's really incredible about North Korea is there's a huge difference between the capital city, Pyongyang, and the countryside, and I've traveled in both places. The city is relatively modern. It's the home to about 2 million North Korean elite. Today, they all have cell phones. They have enough to eat, and their lives are comparatively comfortable. But in the countryside, you can visit within 30 miles of Pyongyang villages that don't look much different than they would have 300 years ago. Electric power is extremely scarce. Agriculture is by hand, not by machine, and the life is very difficult. So it's a country of two or at least two different environments. And one which is poor and miserable for too many people.
And Josh Letterman, this summit in Vancouver, who called it? Why did they decide to have it? What do they expect to accomplish?
Well, the United States and Canada are co-hosting this summit. Secretary Tillerson is up there in Vancouver as we speak, and all the countries that are invited are what's known as the sending countries. In other words, the countries that fought on the same side as the U.S. In the war, invading the country. And the goal of bringing those countries together is not coincidental. It's intentionally symbolic to try to reiterate the military threat and to really increase the pressure on North Korea to show that the rest of the world is not going to sit by as they continue their nuclear weapons program, even as hopes are very cautiously increasing for some type of diplomatic resolution in the wake of these new rare talks between North and South Korea.
So the guest list, Josh, does not include Russia and China. What do you make of that?
Well, it doesn't include those two countries for the reason that this was supposed to bring together the Western and Asian countries that had been involved in that conflict during the war. However, China's government has really spoken out against the fact that they were not invited, saying, look, we are clearly central to any resolution to this, and any kind of meeting that doesn't involve the parties that are inevitably going to be central to a resolution doesn't have any hopes of making a lot of progress.
And Frank Giannuzzi, I mean, that seems like a pretty good argument to me. I mean, why limit it? You know, it seems like a somewhat arbitrary criteria for being invited.
Well, the Chinese are central to any resolution, successful resolution of the conflict on the Korean Peninsula. But I think there's a certain logic to having the countries that fought on the side of the UN forces defending South Korea against the North, meeting together and trying to get all their ducks in a row before you were to then convene a larger peace conference that might involve the Chinese or would have to involve the Chinese and the Russians. So I think there's nothing particularly wrong with it, but the Chinese are not crazy. Clearly, they are central, integral to any solution, and we need their help.
And Josh Letterman, the folks at the State Department, what do they see as their opportunity for leverage with China? I mean, obviously, the president speaks a lot about China's assistance and the need for China's assistance when it comes to North Korea. But as a realistic matter, what does the State Department really think is doable in terms of Chinese cooperation?
Well, the Trump administration looks at what they have been able to achieve over the last 12 months as far as China on the North Korea issue, and they see a rare bright spot. They see that they've actually gotten China to do quite a bit more substantively than the Obama administration was able to do in many years, despite both pursuing essentially the same strategy, which is, you know, China is the country with the most influence over North Korea, therefore let's try to get China to put pressure on North Korea, since it's not like the United States is doing a whole bunch of trade with the North to begin with. So they see a strategy that is slowly paying off for them and want to continue it. And State Department officials have cited that progress in getting China to reduce oil supplies and oil trade with the North and other economic steps as part of what may be driving Kim Jong-un not to the nuclear negotiating table, but to these very delicate early-stage talks with South Korea.
And Frank, let's talk about those early-stage talks with South Korea. For the last several years, two or three years, this phone line between the North and South wasn't used. I guess the South would place a call to the North virtually every day, sometimes two, three times a day, and they just simply wouldn't pick up. All of a sudden, North Korea, a few weeks ago, picked up the phone. How come?
Well, the big difference is you have a new government in Seoul, and the Moon Jae-in government is a progressive government. They came into power explicitly with the mandate to try to improve relations with North Korea and to adopt a more flexible and if you will, even a generous approach toward the North. They're not being soft-headed here. President Moon Jae-in understands the threat emanating from North Korea, including their missile program, but he's determined to improve the relationship. And I think it just took the North about 6 months to assess what kind of a guy are we dealing with. And then they decided, probably for the reasons Josh indicated, a combination of feeling some economic pressure, sensing an opportunity with a more receptive South Korean government, and also wanting maybe to poke a finger a little bit in the American eye, too. They don't like the pressure they've been under from the United States. This is a chance for North Korea to appear more reasonable to the world community and to put on a good show in South Korea at the Olympics. So all those reasons.
Yeah, and Josh, I mean, the president of South Korea seems to have a tremendous public support. I mean, he ran on this platform. The platform was, look, we're going to try to fix things or at least make them better between the South and the North. So the domestic situation in South Korea certainly plays into this in a big way. What are they talking about? What are the topics du jour? I know the Olympics are in the mix, but they seem to be taking baby steps. What are they considering as we speak?
Well, really, the other concrete thing that we know has been discussed in that is the reestablishment of this military hotline between North and South so that they can have a little bit of communication and try to head off anything that could, you know, become explosive. But, you know, even as the North and South were sitting down to those talks, the United States was saying, look, we're in touch with the South Koreans, and this is really about the Olympics, and there's no plans to go further than this. The South Koreans taking a little bit different of an approach, suggesting a little bit more openness to topics that would be broader and start to get them in the direction of how do we work on this broader relationship and the nuclear issue. So a little bit of distance there. And, you know, a lot of the concern that you hear from national security officials here in the United States is that North Korea may be trying to drive a wedge between, you know, U.S. and South Korea to treaty allies by exploiting the fact that, you know, there is this willingness and eagerness, perhaps, by the new South Korean government to pursue diplomatic engagement that's beyond what the Trump administration wants to do, and that if Kim Jong-un can get in there and sort of widen that divide between North and between South Korea and the United States, that it could create a strategic advantage for Pyongyang.
And Frank Januzzi, there are some reports in the press that say that North Korea has even assured South Korea that whatever nuclear arsenal they have is aimed at the United States, and it's not aimed at Seoul, it's not aimed at them. Do you buy that?
Well, it's consistent with long-standing North Korean doctrine. I think the threat that the North perceives from the South is the cultural and political threat. The threat they perceive from the United States is a military threat. And so that nuclear deterrent that they are building very determinedly is focused on the United States and on Japan. They can use conventional artillery and other means to deter South Korea, and there's no evidence that South Korea would ever want to launch a military attack anyway. I think Josh makes a really important point about this wedge issue. I think the real danger of the U.S. ROK alliance drifting apart emanates from Seoul and Washington, not from North Korea. North Korea would undoubtedly like to see the two allies drift apart, but frankly, they don't have the capability to push us apart. It's our own ineptitude, which will, hopefully not, but which could destroy the U.S.-ROK alliance, not the North Koreans.
And give us an example of that.
Well, you know, President Trump's rhetoric during his first year in office was extraordinarily fiery toward the North. I think unnecessarily provocative. And it made the South Korean people really uncomfortable because they're worried that essentially the U.S. is somehow willing to play with their security and prioritize U.S. security alone over that of our ally. And of course, there are 100,000 Americans in South Korea who would be in jeopardy if there were to be a conflict. So it behooves the United States to listen to a South Korean ally and coordinate closely with them and not to disregard South Korea's interests.
And Josh Letterman, when it comes to consensus within the Trump administration about an approach to the Korean Peninsula, we have some famous examples of the Secretary of State disagreeing quite publicly with the president about what's worth it, what's not. What's your take on Tillerson's status at the moment? I mean, a month ago at this time, we were saying, well, Tillerson's out. Basically, they're waiting till after Christmas and New Year's, and then they're gonna punt Tillerson. They're gonna appoint Pompeo, and they're gonna move Tom Cotton, the senator from Arkansas, into the CIA. Everybody sort of thought this is a fait accompli, it's a done deal. And here we are on the 15th, 16th of January, and Tillerson is running the meeting in Vancouver. What's your take on Tillerson's status?
Well, the general contours of this debate within the administration have been somewhat consistent. We want a diplomatic resolution, not a war, obviously, and, you know, the pathway to that would be some type of negotiations that North Korea doesn't seem to be showing they're ready for by continuing to test and take other provocative actions. The difference between Tillerson and some of the other members of the administration, Nikki Haley, the president himself, has been, as far as, you know, willingness and eagerness to to launch into those talks and sort of what the conditions would have to be. And every time somebody says something a little bit different than what had been the standard line, the administration scrambles to say, no, we're all saying the same thing, and that has been not a particularly compelling case to make. Just in the last few minutes, Tillerson in Vancouver has been reiterating, the basic U.S. stance on this, rejecting China's proposal, for instance, for a freeze-for-freeze approach where the United States would halt some of those military exercises with South Korea that the North sees as a rehearsal for invasion, and North Korea would put a pause, so to speak, on their nuclear program. That's been a longstanding U.S. position that they're standing by. But as far as Tillerson, you know, all indications are he plans to stay in this role as long as the president will allow him to continue to do so. And if there is an opportunity for talks with North Korea, we know that Secretary Tillerson is eager to be a driving participant in those talks.
Josh Letterman covers foreign policy, national security, and the State Department for the Associated Press. He's kind enough to give us up-to-the-minute updates from Vancouver, where there is currently underway a summit sponsored by the United States and Canada on the problems in the Korean Peninsula. Frank Januzzi is the president and CEO of the Maureen and Mike Mansfield Foundation. They specialize in Asia affairs. Our phone number here on Midday when we come back from a break, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, to send us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall. We're glad you're with us. Stick around.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR, where you're tuned to Midday.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. By the way, coming up tomorrow, Baltimore City Schools CEO Sonia Santelises joins me for the hour here in Studio A. It has been a rocky start in this new year for city schools, with many buildings closed for heating malfunctions the week before last. But that is by no means the whole story of what's going on in classrooms across the city. We will hear from Dr. Santelises tomorrow about efforts to fix the decaying infrastructure of our aging buildings and efforts to improve the funding process for capital projects. Among other issues, we will take your calls and comments. So Dr. Sonia Santelises tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, we're talking about North Korea, which has recently resumed communication with South Korea. Josh Letterman covers international affairs for the Associated Press. He joins us on the phone from Washington. And joining me here in the studio, Frank Januzzi, the president and CEO of the Mike Mansfield Foundation. You can join us as well, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Frank Januzzi, I want to follow up on a comment you made in the first segment about the difference between the military threat and the cultural political threat. How does the North perceive the threat of cultural and political exchanges? For example, one of the things they seem to be talking about is sending an orchestra to the Olympics. The BBC is reporting today that the Simyon Band, which is a large orchestra mostly of women who play string instruments, will be playing at the Olympics next month.
Well, it's really important to try to get inside the heads of the North Koreans and understand the motivation behind their nuclear weapons program and really what's driving the state. And as hard as that is to do, they make it easier because they put some stuff out there for us for public consumption. And we know how sensitive they are about their international reputation. It's why they object if they're added to a list of state sponsors of terrorism. It's why they complain when the United Nations criticizes them for their human rights record. It really gets to them. Insults about their military posturing, those don't bother them as much. But so they care about their reputation because long term, they're in a struggle for dominance on the Korean Peninsula. And right now they're facing a South Korea that is 50 or 100 times stronger economically, a strong, robust democracy, a multi-party system with legitimacy. And this represents a real political and economic obstacle to their ultimate vision of unification.
And Josh Letterman, there's a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a fellow that Frank knows well, a guy named Nicholas Eberstadt. And Nick appeared before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee recently talking about Korea. And one of the points that he made was that inclusion in the international community is actually not in the best interest of North Korea, because if they can keep their people isolated, unaware of what's going on in the rest of the world, unaware of how the rest of the world lives, it will allow them to continue their military buildup and continue this journey, which seems absolutely hell-bent on having the nuclear capacity to reach the United States. How do you react to that argument? What do you think folks at the State Department would say to that?
Well, I think that is certainly a concern that you can't bring about any domestic demand for a change in the way North Korea's government operates if the people there are being kept in the dark. But, you know, it's difficult really to tell from the outside, except for when people are able to get in, and a few news organizations, including the AP, that have permanent presences there, to really get a strong sense of how much information is flowing, particularly to people that are outside of Pyongyang. But we know that one of the things that the United States has tried to do, including under the Trump administration, is to try to, you know, expand the amount of information people can get there, you know, to the extent possible, send information over the border, and that as technology has improved, people there are able to get more, at least, than they were in the past. You know, now you can fit entire DVDs of Western films and other information onto tiny little computer, chips, thumb drives, for lack of a better word, that can be smuggled over relatively easily, and that at least some of that is making its way to folks inside North Korea.
Yeah.
Tom, I think this is a really critical point. This country is not, North Korea is not hermetically sealed any longer. The horse is out of the barn. Even in the countryside, the North Koreans have a much keener awareness of the world around them than they ever used to. There's now 2 million cell phones in Pyongyang, and they're talking to each other all the time. So you really have a different situation. But the reason this is so important is that for North Korea, both isolation and the economic threat that presents, as well as integration and having to be more open to the world and having information and visitors and investors and tourists, both of those are a threat. And this is why when the United States presents North Korea and says, we want you to make a strategic choice, we want you to choose peace and integration instead of isolation and threat, it's why it's a rather tough choice for the North, because frankly, both choices are fraught with peril.
Well, the president, whether or not military threats have any impact or not, certainly doesn't shy away from making them. This are some comments that he made back in August, on the 8th of August. He was at his golf resort in Bedminster, New Jersey. Reporters asked him a couple of things about North Korea. This is what he had to say.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
So clearly, Josh Letterman, that's going to send chills up the spines of South Koreans. It sent chills up the spines of most Americans. And here we have this specter of the state of Hawaii sending out a mistaken alert about a ballistic missile attack on that island just the other day, and we saw how shook up people were, quite understandably. Just days before the president made those remarks in August, the UN Security Council imposed new sanctions on North Korea. This carrot and stick approach, I mean, how is the State Department assessing the efficacy of sanctions at this moment against North Korea?
Well, the State Department has said that they've made a lot of progress, that the sanctions that they've been able to get other countries to adhere to more than in the past have choked off a lot of North Korea's economy. You know, they've been pressing countries to end other programs that were less noticed, such as North Korea's guest worker program, where they send citizens into other countries to work in restaurants and other places and then basically send remittances back into the country. They've been able to make a lot of progress in that. But, you know, you hear the fire and fury threat and the rhetoric from the president that has made a lot of people really anxious. And, you know, officials at the Pentagon, at the State Department say, you know, yes, maybe that's not how we would put it, but that they do see this as restoring the credibility of a military threat against North Korea that they feel was lost in the Obama administration, particularly after, you know, Obama's red line moment with Syria, where he then did not strike in the wake of apparent chemical weapons use. That now under Trump, by talking openly about these military options, that they have made it so that when people threaten military action from the United States, they think that North Korea is listening much more seriously than it would have otherwise.
And he's not just talking at his golf resort; he's talking at the United Nations. This is a clip of the president speaking at the UN about 6 weeks after he made his famous or infamous fire and fury remarks in August, and he again does not back down for a second.
Now North Korea's reckless pursuit of nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles threatens the entire world with unthinkable loss of human life. It is an outrage that some nations would not only trade with such a regime, but would arm, supply, and financially support a country that imperils the world with nuclear conflict. No nation on earth has an interest in seeing this band of criminals arm itself with nuclear weapons and missiles. The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able, but hopefully this will not be necessary.
So Frank Chinnizzi, he's calling the leader of North Korea Rocket Man. He's making, you know, calling him names like a kid at a sandbox in front of the UN. But is it your contention that, you know, Kim Jong-un really didn't care about that kind of stuff? It's not going to bother him, because so many people say, let's not excite this guy. He's just as crazy. Kim is just as crazy as many people think the president of the United States is. We have these two volatile figures. We are really playing with fire here.
Well, I guess the good news is there's no evidence that Kim is crazy. He shows every sign of being a very rational, careful actor. And I don't think that the president's rhetoric, even though it was rather intensely personal, especially bothers Kim Jong-un. I want to make a broader point, though. You know, I was working at the State Department 25 years ago during the first nuclear crisis. And this sense of urgency that the president has injected into the North Korean situation actually is essential to getting any real progress on diplomacy. People don't understand, or many people may not remember, how close we were to a conflict in 1994 when Secretary of Defense Bill Perry was preparing military options on the Korean Peninsula. And it was precisely that combination of engagement and military pressure that yielded the 1994 agreed framework, which silenced and froze North Korea's nuclear program for almost a decade. So the president may be crazy like a fox here. If he's injecting a sense of urgency and drama into this crisis, it can work if it is mated up to a patient diplomatic strategy. And I do have real questions about the second part of that equation.
Let's go to the phones. Frank in Aberdeen, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Good afternoon. I wrote this in anticipation of Mr. Trump claiming credit for North and South getting back together. Kim Jong-un needs the Olympics. News of the games could not be blocked. Kim needs his team for his evening news. Meanwhile, Trump did act like an enzyme, bringing together both North and South, each motivated by a common concern. The 45 pointed at both of them.
Well, that's an interesting take. Josh Letterman, what do you think? Kim needs the Olympics. He wasn't going to be able to stay isolated, I guess, during the Olympics with the world's attention focused on the peninsula for the way it's going to be.
I'm not so sure that's the reason that he's interested. I don't know that the North Korean government, you know, particularly fears you know, a domestic backlash over something like the Olympics. But I think that it fits in with, you know, the broader theme of the moment, which is, you know, this charm offensive, for lack of a better word, from the North Koreans, you know, showing openness to these, you know, very preliminary talks, wanting to participate in something that, you know, frankly, is very difficult for the rest of the world to argue they shouldn't be, you know, that we should be punishing, you know, athletes in North Korea who want to compete alongside their colleagues from the rest of the world. And I think that Kim Jong-un knows that when North Korea does try to participate in these things, it does create a bit of a split. You know, the U.S., the Trump administration has been pushing every other country to isolate North Korea. That's our policy, you know, make them feel like pariahs in the world, and maybe eventually they'll get the picture. Well, this has really, you know, this is a major exception to that. I mean, the United States is supporting North Korea's participation in the Olympics, you know, through these talks with South Korea. And as a result, you know, one can argue, well, the administration's split. They're not actually pursuing, you know, a one cohesive policy. And I think that probably has more to do with it than, you know, concerns that North Koreans would, you know, protest in the streets or something if they weren't allowed to be in the Olympics.
Josh Lederman covers international affairs for the AP. Frank Januzzi is with me here in the studio. He's the president and CEO of the Mike Mansfield Foundation. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. 410-662-8780 is our phone number, our email midday@wypr.org. Herman and Waverly, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, hi, Tom. My feeling is that sanctions are not going to get the North Koreans to reduce their armaments program at all. To paraphrase Putin, he said they'll eat grass before they do that. But what we really need, I think, is a mutual non-aggression treaty with them. Some real firm, believable, honest agreement that neither country is going to aggress against the other. And once that's in place, then you can start talking about reducing their nuclear program. But sanctions are not going to do it.
Yeah, well, thanks for that perspective, Herman. I appreciate it. Frank, what are the chances of that?
Well, I think that Herman's right that sanctions by themselves are never going to convince North Korea to disarm. And that's both because the North Koreans themselves are extremely proud, resilient, and willing to sacrifice civilians in order to continue their pursuit of these weapons. And also because China does not want to impose sanctions that are so severe that it would cause the collapse of North Korea, refugee crisis, and instability on their border. So we need sanctions, I believe, because it can enhance the diplomats in their negotiations. But Herman's exactly right. And one of the things we need to do is to think about playing small ball. You know, we're here in Baltimore. We've got the Orioles. They often swing for the fences. They're very, very effective at the home run. We're not going to be able to hit a home run to solve the North Korean problem. We've got to play National League ball, bunt, steal, sack fly, make small progress. The main concern I have with Herman's recommendation about sort of a non-aggression pact is that potentially you leave in place a North Korean state armed with nuclear weapons for 50, 60, 70 years. I don't think that's a prospect anyone really can feel very sanguine about. And long term, will that drive proliferation of nuclear weapons to North Korea's neighbors, South Korea and Japan, Taiwan?
Yeah. Josh Lederman, there's also the specter when it comes to diplomatic talks. There's a specter of the president himself speaking with Kim Jong-un. He raised this possibility, it appeared, in an article, in an interview with the Wall Street Journal. This interview is now a source of great contention between the White House and the Wall Street Journal because the president was reported to have said, "I probably have a very good relationship with Kim Jong-un," which, of course, took everybody by surprise. He said, "I have relationships with people. I think you people are surprised." He said that he didn't want to comment on whether or not he had actually spoken with Kim Jong-un. He said, "I don't want to comment on it. I'm not saying I have or haven't. I just don't want to comment." So the White House is now saying that he didn't say, "I probably have a very good relationship with Kim." He's saying, I would probably have a great relationship. I don't know. I heard the tape. Sounds to me like he said, "I probably have a good relationship." What do you make of this little kerfluffle, Josh Lederman?
I don't make a whole lot of out of it. I mean, the president says he has a good relationship with literally everybody. I mean, you can't go back to, you know, any world leader, even one that is considered an enemy of the United States, where he doesn't say, you know, that he either has a good relationship or that they would get along, you know, really well.
So even one that he's maybe never met.
Yeah, I mean, there are no indications, you know, that the president has spoken to Kim Jong-un. I would be shocked to learn that had happened. And I don't think there's any real sense that if there were to be negotiations, that it would be at that level to begin with. I mean, that's not the way. I mean, the North Koreans have always wanted to proceed very cautiously on this. You know, everything starts with these, you know, really informal, you know, track two talks where you've got, you know, retired government people or professors talking to North Koreans, or you know, really casual interactions in New York where the North Koreans maintain a presence at the United Nations, you know, or on the sidelines of, you know, talks about releasing detainees. But it seems like, you know, there needs to be a trust-building exercise where you go from low-level, you know, increasingly working up the scale of what kind of officials are involved and what kind of topics are broached. I think it would be probably unlikely to see that jump those steps with the conversation between the two leaders.
And Frank Genizzi, this has engendered an entire conversation about the United States' nuclear capability and who has the authority to launch a first strike nuclear attack. Speaking of former diplomats, we have 17 former nuclear launch officers who have signed a petition and sent it to Congress seeking to rein in the president's authority to do just that. They say that there are a number of good proposals before Congress right now that would limit the president's power to be the only person to order a first use nuclear attack. Where do you think that's going to go?
Well, the key thing for your listeners to understand is that there's a difference between a preemptive attack, which would be the United States seeing North Korea, preparing to launch an attack against us, and the United States deciding to preempt it and hit first. That's a right that no U.S. president is ever going to give up. It's a right that need not be reined in by Congress. But the president has spoken a little bit about a preventive attack. This is an attack against North Korea's capabilities because we don't like the fact that they're developing nuclear missiles. I think the Congress needs to have a long, close look at both the question of whether the United States should be able to use nuclear weapons without congressional authorization in such a circumstance, as well as the president's unbridled authority to take the nation to war that way, a war that's not forced upon him, but is a war of choice. And the Congress is debating several pieces of legislation right now that would begin to examine these presidential powers. I think, frankly, they don't have much chance of passage. And, of course, were they to pass, the president would surely veto. But I think it's a debate the nation has to have about the circumstances under which we go to war and the role of the American people and the Congress in authorizing any such war.
And Josh Letterman, let me give you the last word here as we go to a break. I mean, when all said and done, the policy of the United States, the administration, and the sentiment in Congress is that a non-nuclear North Korea is the only solution or the only end game that anybody would accept at this juncture. People are not willing to embrace the notion that Kim Jong-un could have a nuclear arsenal, but then, you know, explore other ways, as our caller was suggesting, to limit his use of that. Do I have that right?
That's right. And this is really where the conversation starts to go off the rails a bit because, I mean, let's face it, they already have nuclear weapons. They just don't have, you know, the ability, according to U.S. intelligence, perhaps, to deliver them to the U.S. mainland, you know, to master that reentry of a missile. But, you know, even at the end of last year, Kim Jong-un was basically declaring that they had achieved that threshold, that they, you know, are now a nuclear state, and, you know, trying to persuade a country to eliminate its nuclear weapons is something that is a lot harder than persuading them not to do it in the first place. So while, you know, it would obviously be domestically impossible for Trump to say, you know, oh, you know, we, you know, I guess it's okay for North Korea to have nuclear weapons, and likewise, North Korea is not going to, you know, open the door to getting rid of them. I think everybody knows that if there is some type of resolution to this diplomatically, it will amount to some type of compromise between those two hardline positions.
Josh Letterman covers international affairs for the AP. Josh, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Frank Januzzi is the president and CEO of the Mike Mansfield Foundation and evidently a candidate for coach of the Baltimore Orioles. Good to see you, Frank. Thank you for coming in. Appreciate it.
Good to see you, Tom.
We're going to take a little bit of a break. After that quick break, we're going to turn our focus on foreign affairs to Africa and the global condemnation of President Trump's comments in a meeting with congressional leaders last week. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.